Today's lecture is going to be on more of future concepts than history things. What we're going to focus on today is concepts for making software more modular that are out there as an alternative to the things that we have seen before the season's holidays. So it's kind of alternatives to inheritance, especially multiple inheritance. And the things are going to be called mixins and traits. So that's the general concept that we're going to tackle today. What's out there as advanced techniques for modularization instead of just multiple implementation inheritance. So what we're going to look at today is we're going to have a look at mixins and traits, and both of them are built up in kind of a similar way. First of all, we're going to look at a few motivating problems, or at least situations where we see that we are doing repetitive stuff over and over again, which can't be addressed in a comfortable way with the concepts that we have seen so far. And we're going to focus on the actual background in the sense that we're going to have a look at what we gain in terms of expressivity from the particular concept that we're going to look at, and then we're going to have a look at the at programming languages that have tendencies to implement those principles or even fully support those concepts in practice. So that's the agenda for today. Let's hope that we'll get it done in our time slot today. So the questions that that we're hovering around all the time is this concept of reusability. How can we achieve the most flexibility with just writing our code once? And so far, we have had as our core concept that we want to have something like code sharing in object-oriented systems, and one of the leading principles that we have seen there is that we do that in an inheritance-centric way, in the sense that we get to reuse code that we have already written by inheriting from a certain parent. We have seen that there's different flavors of that. Specifically, there's the single inheritance thing where we don't have to do a lot for supporting that, because there's this nice idea of arranging our object layout such that we can reuse most of the code that we have already written for parents to also work with our with the children. Then there was the idea of going over to multiple inheritance, where we don't restrict ourselves to just one parent, but we have to do a lot of jumping through hoops in order to get to get the system to work as we intended to do. So that's quite a lot of effort to spend in order to get all these flavors of multiple inheritance working. All in all, these solutions are in principle there to solve problems around what we call decomposition and composition problems. So first of all, we have a kind of a situation which we have to decompose in certain units of action, so to say, and have to recompose in the constraints that we get from the means that our language offers, in the sense that we have to somehow fit it into the hierarchies that we get imposed by single inheritance, or that we have to fit it all into the structures that we can create via multiple inheritance. Still, is that a convenient way to design things? First of all, I've tried to find a few motivating examples where the means that we get from single and multiple inheritance are maybe not as elegant as we would have liked. First of all, let's start with and with means like having just single inheritance, for example, trying to come up with, of course, something silly, because silly things are the only things that that fit on slides. So here we go. The adventure game, which has kind of dungeons in there, and dungeons prominently would like to have doors, because otherwise you can already see your targets. So there's doors in there, and to get a little bit more variety in there, there's the concept of having short door, which is in the sense of object orientation, something like a specialized door. So it's child of door, as well as locked door, which could also be something like a special door, as well, you cannot open it as easy as you would think you do. And then you continue on designing and come up with something like the short locked door. And in single inheritance, as you now ask yourself, well, I would like to do modular code, but short locked door, although it shares attributes with the short door and the locked door and is just a specialized door, can't really be fitted into. And there's, well, I don't know what you would do in that situation. Is there something that you that immediately comes to your mind when you see such a such a problem? So we could. We can just decide on one of the branches, you want to say, by just fixing it like that and just, well, for example, just inherit from here and rewrite the code that we have from, that we would have had over here. Well, could do so. Yeah, switching the language then would be another idea, of course. But yeah, just with the means that we have. Well, what I'm playing with is moving your focus from inheritance as the means of sharing code over to aggregation as being the principle of sharing code between each other. So that is kind of another idea. It looks complicated, and don't know whether it's so natural to come to that. So that would incorporate something like an interface, the door-like, which is applicable for all our components out there, and doors all have in common that they that persons can pass through that or persons can open through that. So ideas for that would be to have a kind of a door as the very basic concept of that, that would terminate our chains, and certain other components in there, like short and locked, that can be chained one after each other in a chain of aggregations, which would terminate in our basic door object at some point. Which would mean that we would have all of those intermediate and terminating entities implementing this door-like interface. And if it doesn't contribute to any of that, we would just have something like a dummy in there, because at some point the door might be called with can pass, and the default way of passing through the door would be just, yeah, well, just do it, for example. And yeah, that would circumvent the whole problematic thing of having to inherit from several parents, with the price of just don't using inheritance at all at that point. And you might ask whether that is the way to actually deal with it, just circumvent it. Well, also, you from a point of view of design, you might ask yourself whether it's a good idea to have an interface that have to anticipate what wrappers you want to use afterwards at some point. You have to always be aware of existing in such a chain, in the sense that you might receive a call to one of your methods, and you also have to issue a call to your predecessor in the chain after you have done the stuff that you wanted to do so far. So there must be at least some kind of cooperation around there, or the alternative would be having the door work on its list of door likes by just calling each of these things one after each other, so that there needs to be facilities implemented manually within the door for every one of these things. So, yeah, it's a lot of fuss around and a lot of glue code to write, and well, in the end, you get something like modularity in there, but it might not be a perfect way of doing so. Of course, you can always argument the way that, well, you could have chosen an appropriate language beforehand and be done with that. Well, for that example, for that particular example, that might be true, but there's also other examples out there. Let's think about streams, a way of abstracting input-output, and you can have these kind of hierarchies in the streams where you specialize the, more and more and more with each of the children, and you might also end up in branching at as soon as you hit a certain spot where things are just going to be treated differently for different purposes. For example, at one point in time, you would like to split between file streams and socket streams in the sense of that one has to do with network, the other one with disk I/O or something. And still, there might be need for even more specialization, specifically at a point where you want to offer your streams to multi-threaded systems where you are at some point interested in performing synchronized accesses to the streams. If you don't want your streams to do anything with threads, you might not want to have synchronization at all because the costs. Remember back in autumn we talked about all the things that have to happen on the bus? Well, you don't want to have that if you are really sure that you will never gonna touch threads anyway. So there's a need for attaching something like synchronized accesses to file streams that might already have branched some point earlier in your hierarchies. So how could you do that even with multiple inheritance? You have to keep in mind that multiple inheritance is only referring, well, it's kind of a many-to-one relation in the sense that you can have many parents and just one child, but that's not the other way around. You can't attach one child in a flexible way to several parents. So that's not the direction the whole system works. So for that thing where you would like to attach this synchronization adapter to your streams with inheritance, multiple inheritance is not the way to go. Also creating individual special wrapping classes for the socket stream and the file stream, well, come on, that's just, well, repeating your work over and over again, and that's also not what we want to do. Then there's the idea of having something like aggregation in there. That was the solution for last problems, for the last problem, and in our sense, if we would do that, we would, for example, create a synchronized read-write stream, which would carry via aggregation arbitrary other stream within itself, and then would redirect all these read and write things to that particular child. However, that would undo your kind of specialization because your stream now is not a specialized file stream anymore, but it might be a specialized stream at some point. Don't know, that might do, but you cannot really map the completeness of the attributes. Like, it's not a specialized socket stream if it's also applicable to the file stream. So that just doesn't work with aggregation. Also, it needs all the things that you want to connect to your wrapper to have actually to actually have a common ancestor, and not only to have a common ancestor, but a common ancestor that is near enough to your to the things you want to wrap around, such that you can obtain all the functionalities that you want to call from there. Otherwise, you won't see the relevant methods to call. So it's not a perfect solution in that sense. Then there's also the other way to do that with multiple inheritance, in the sense that you just add, or somehow try to add in your functionality by cross-inheriting from some kind of library module, but that still leaves you having to re-implement these wrapping methods, read and write, each time for each of the produced children classes, because you still need to insert the correct calls at the right positions within your code. So you don't save as much as you would like to save in terms of modularization and rewriting your code. And yeah, that might also not be the right thing. And then there's the another idea, but just putting your code as high up as possible to a point where all of your I see grim faces there. That's just really counterintuitive and might even be harmful, in the sense that you get to see functionality and methods that you're actually not supposed to see at layers above, and actually carrying that around for just an optional addition to your hierarchy is just not going to do it. And that will create very fragile hierarchies, and it's very doubtful from a sense of designing your objects. So, all in all, we got a lot of different problems of how to decompose your functionality and redistribute it on the class hierarchies that you have. There's a certain lack of fine-grained control on how you want to distribute that. It might create very fragile hierarchies. You might end up with a lot of duplicated code. And yeah, these are all matters that are not so clearly solved right now. So before we gonna tackle these different problems, let's maybe go back, step back one step to have a look at what we're actually talking about when we talk about these classes and objects and all that. If we look at that from a kind of an abstract point of view, the generalized thing of what we're looking at is not a technical thing with a lot of tables involved and redirections and all that, but we kind of dealing with queries to mapping, so to say. So we have the desire to issue a certain command and then get back the address of a code that we want to execute at some point. So that is kind of the general interface to something like a object-oriented system. So to formalize that, we would assume that in such systems we would always have these kinds of names, which is these queries that we can issue to these mappings, and we get back some handle to something that we can call. So that is these method bodies or method addresses. Don't care. For me, it's just an abstract element of such a set. That's the most abstract way that I can think of something like that. And our basic blocks on what we build our hierarchies and designs from is just, I call it classes, and they are, in principle, they are maps that map these name things to elements from certain sets, for example, the set of method bodies. So that's this one here. We can also map to other classes that might not be so obvious, but we'll see where we will need that a little bit later on. And in the sense that we want, maybe also want to access something like attributes at some point, we might also be interested in obtaining numbers, in the sense that you want to have offsets to the start of the object in order to access certain fields. And the important thing now for delving deeper into what we can do with these classes and how we can arrange and calculate with them is that we also bring our concept of having not a concrete entry to a name into the game by introducing a symbol for abstract methods, methods that have not been provided with a concrete address that we can jump to or which we can call so far. That's this bottom symbol, like there's nothing to call yet. And then there's the concept of, well, there might be several sources of information, of maps, that tell us differently about how we have to interpret our name. So we cannot decide right now what the actual concrete method will be. That is kind of information overflow. There's too much information at that point, in the sense that we have conflicting information. Thus, that's a symbol for in conflict. That is our top symbol. And when we start trying to introduce ways of computing with classes or ways to have to compose classes, we will going to be using... we're going to update our maps, especially in the sense that we will update entries. And thus, it might be interesting to have kind of certain concepts of how we can compare entries in our maps. And for this, we have our partial order between the members of our mappings. And yeah, the thing is that in principle we just say everything is incomparable except for everything is better than abstract, and in conflict is kind of stronger than everything else. That is what's expressed here. So bottom is weaker than every concrete entry in such a mapping, and top is stronger than every concrete entry in the thing, which leads to a certain pattern of our lattice, or well, of our members of these mappings. So we have numbers and method bodies and classes, which kind of operate all on the same level. They are incomparable to each other, but all of them are dominated by the conflicting state, and all of them are stronger than an abstract field. So then, what is an abstract class in that sense? A function from names to class elements with at least one abstract image is called an abstract class. Well, so far, I think... Yeah, so then if we look further, what is interfaces and classes? Interfaces are considered to be abstract classes for which all of the entries that we find are actually abstract. And that's now the next one, I think. While reading, I already got the first thing, the at least one I think needs to go from that definition, otherwise the last thing won't work. So ignore the at least one. Generally, we talk about abstract classes. An abstract class is an interface if every entry is abstract, and a concrete class is a class where every entry is larger than abstract and not in conflict, which is... oh. Which is meant with this one. So that is concrete classes. So, yeah, still crossing out. General, a function is just an abstract class per se, and if we look more in detail into it, we can say whether it's a concrete class or an interface. So, when we talk about the set of all possible classes, we talk about the family of classes C. So that's going to be the symbol that we're going to use when we want to talk about the set of all possible classes. So now let's continue with what we can do with classes that are found in that set. And what we're particularly interested is in using these abstract classes as containers for modules that we're gonna somehow attach to each other in order to generate new functionality and new containers that solve our problems. And for that, we need to somehow come up with ways of composing these two. So that's still a box. We don't know what to put in there. And there's several ideas of how to compute on the level of these classes, which are in principle only just mappings. So how can we compose these things? There's at least here I have assembled two of the ways of composing classes that just made sense to me. There would be other ways, but those are the ones that I found useful in general class-oriented systems. So the first of them is the symmetric join, denoted with that specific operator, also known as the least upper bound. And what that does is, well, you would define that thing component-wise, and when you look up a certain value n in the symmetrical join of the classes C1 and C2, you would map to the least upper bound between the elements B1 and B2 with respect to their ordering that we had one slide ago. Remember, there was ordering going on between the bottom element, which is the abstract, the top element, which is the in conflict, and actual elements, which are all incomparable to each other. And what we have here is the least upper bound operator, which means that we have to find the element which is lowest of all those which still dominate B1 and B2 in this diamond thing. That's just an upper bound on both of them. It's still stronger, or at least as strong as each of two things that we want to perform our least upper bound operator on, but it's the lowest of what we can find, and in the sense the most precise. And that is just the way that it is defined over here. So in case that, it's very laggy today, in case that B1, for example, is undefined, then we're just gonna say whatever B2 is, it's gonna be the result of the operation. Probably clear, because, well, if one of them is the very least of the whole diamond thing, then whatever the other one is, it will surely be stronger or at least not weaker. So that's about that. Oh, maybe confusing for you was that I didn't mention what the B1 and the B2 would be. It's just the respective entries of n in class 1 or class 2. So that is just what is the entry in both of the classes under this specific name. So that's B1 and B2. And these are the things that are comparable to each other, because it might be method bodies and attribute offsets and all that. So anyway, if B1 is the abstract one, then B2 will for sure be taken, and the and if C1 doesn't even have an entry for that name, also B2 is going to dominate because, well, doesn't matter. So same is for the other possibility where we would have B2 as undefined, as abstract. Then of course B1 will be the one that that's going to be the result of that operation because, well, same reasoning as before, just the other way around. Then, when will we ever see a concrete concrete method body or class name or attribute offset as a result of our least upper bound? Well, we were going to see that in case that B1 and B2 are actually the same. So that's the only way that we can get an actual value as a result of the whole thing, because otherwise, if it would be different values in there, we would need to still get the lowest dominator of both of them, and yeah, that's just not an element of that thing, but instead this top or conflicting thing. So only if both of them are the same, we would result in either of them. So I just take B2, but it also could be B1. Doesn't matter. It's the same anyway. And in case that we actually have differing entries for the same name in C1 and C2, which would be the other case, well, we can't say what we actually want to see in there. Thus, we will say it's in conflict. And that is exactly why the whole thing is called the symmetric join, because both of the maps that we join with each other have the same rank. So neither of them dominates the other in their entries. And if both of them say different things, we will treat the thing as in conflict. Okay? So that is what the symmetric join is. In contrast, there's also another operation of composing them with each other, which is the asymmetric join. I've just taken the same symbol as before and added a small arrow to just stress the partner that is actually dominating the other one. So where the point goes, that's the one who dominates. So once again, component-wise, if I look up a name in the asymmetric join of two of these maps, I'm going to ask C1 first. So C1 is always the one who provides the answer in case that there is an entry for that name in C1. And only if there's just no entry for that, we will gonna answer with C2. That's pretty easy compared to the symmetric join, but I think if you have this drawing in mind, this one here, this least upper bound is not so bad to comprehend. You always have to, if you pick things from there and there, you're gonna have to find something that dominates from above. So the only way to dominate those two is, no, it's not the only one, it's this one and this one, but you need to get the least one, so it's this one, for example. So with that diagram, sort of, you can always visualize what you're going to do with this least upper bound computation. But yeah, the other one, of course, is very easy. You always ask the one on the left-hand side before. So that's the two possibilities that I see being used out there quite often. Of course, you could come up with some other funky way of composing those things, but yeah, I've not seen any useful things made of that. So, as an example, there's different flavors of inheritance out there, of course, and the one that we see the most time usually these days is the one that originates back to the times of Smalltalk. So that's Smalltalk inheritance. That's inheritance where children in our modeling, children's methods dominate the methods that stem from parents. That's the archetype for the typical languages that we have, like Java or C Sharp or something like that. And what you also get is somehow a way of explicitly referring to the parent of the final object. So what you get out of that is the so-called, or in our context called the small talk inheritance. And we have a symbol for that, which is this small triangle. And that's what we consider to be inheritance, in the same way as it would be kind of this arrowhead between our diagrams. So we would have the child on the left-hand side and the parent on the right-hand side, and this little relational symbol between them. And that would be defined with the signature of being a binary operator between two classes, and it would yield another class in the sense as we had classes as mappings from names to whatever. And it would be actually defined as C1 inherits from C2, and that would be resolved as this asymmetric join between a new mapping that maps super to the parent, this one, and then it would, the second operand would be another asymmetric join between the actual functions of C1 and C2. So, we would, for everything which is not super, we would first of all consider the child, C1, and only if there's no entry in C1 for our query, we would go over to C2. So, if we would do that as an example here, let's look at the doors example in that calculus. The door here, well, we see that everything maps to just abstract here, so that is an interface. It has an entry for can pass and can open. Okay. Then we have a concept which is we call here the locked door. The locked door is another new mapping from can open to a certain method body or an address of a method. And it small talk like inherits from door. And we can now just put things in all the variables. So what the result of that would be a mapping from super to door. Of course, door is the parent in that relation. That would dominate the composition of this can open, which has which is this inlined mapping here, and the mapping that we have created as door, while our inline thing here would be dominating the entries within door. And in the end, as a result, when we compute all of that, we would get first of all the asymmetric join between the door and the can open, and can open is present in both of them, so we have to decide on which one we take. We have the asymmetric join, thus we will have to prefer the one where the arrow points to, so we will prefer the actual concrete entry of can open, so we have can open in there in the version of our thing here. And we take the can pass from the original door because we didn't see it in our locked doors inline function here. And finally, we have to add super maps to door for some way of accessing our predecessor and the whole thing. Now you also see why we have put these class references in the definition of what we carry in our mappings. So it's kind of, yeah, something like that. I've always talked about this kind of inline provided mapping here. This is the way of having this incremental updating way of designing software. That's what you do when we do extensions of methods. You provide such an update to, or an extension to, an already existing class. That's what you do here also. You provide that as the update and door as the method that you extend. So that's just that. Good. You might wonder whether there's something else out there which is not a small talk inheritance. I've found you something, and that is beta inheritance. Probably all of you have already heard of beta, I'm sure. I never did, but you might be more educated than me. So beta dates back, well, not centuries, but decades, and has been coming up in times when these object-oriented systems were just fresh and new, and it had a little bit of a different design aspect in mind than our usual object-oriented systems have nowadays. The main goal was not flexibility and modularity, but more security. So beta was a language that was meant to be used in highly dangerous systems where you have contact to a lot of people that might be killed or some other dangerous hazards. So you were extremely careful in what you would offer as expressivity in your language, especially with you would take care that you don't do things unwillingly, like overwriting things that you didn't intend to overwrite. And that was the main concern with the people who designed beta, that you would, well, maybe not the main thing, but one of the concerns that they had, especially with object orientation. So replacement of a method by a child method, and thus unwillingly destroy something in the internals of your parent, was one of the major concerns of the people who did this beta language. So in this language, you would explicitly have to enable spots where you can actually overwrite later on in your class hierarchy. And you would do so by having the parents' methods dominate the child's methods in every case, except if within the parents' code, at some point, you would mention the keyword inner, which is kind of the corresponding thing to the super in the Smalltalk inheritance. And only if you explicitly refer to this inner thing, you would, if there is a child that offers an overwritten version of your method, then dispatch to that thing. So if you try to bring it down to the formulas that we have introduced before, I've conveniently chosen the arrow pointing in the other direction to kind of symbolize that in this case the parents' methods dominate. And it's just the other way around than before. It's now C2, which was the place where we put our parent into as the second operand. That would be the dominating structure to be queried for name resolution. And only if you use the explicitly this inner thing, you would dispatch your queries to the child. And believe me, you don't want to see better code here. It's once again one of these languages which have just a completely unusual syntax for people who are in this flow of Java and C++ and all that. And I've just kind of provided something like an equivalent syntax. Of course, that's not beta here, but I've just put something like this inner in there, and yeah, hope that with explaining you get the gist of what this better intelligence does. So imagine that you want to have something modeling people within your highly critical system. So you would introduce class person. There's a person is called a specific name, and there would also be a toString method. And within the toString method, you would ordinarily just output the name. And then there's this specific thing here, this inner toString, which would indicate that if there is an overwritten version in a child, then you're allowed to, at that specific point, actually call that thing. And come on, the child would be, in this case, the graduate, which would extend the person, and which would then just explicitly have to be called an extension, and the toString would then return PhD, and that would be the thing that could be appended to the name thing. So kind of in that way you would specify your inheritance in the better system. Yeah, I think we're all satisfied now that there's several ways of having inheritance out there, as unusual as it gets. Due to time reasons, I don't want to talk about attributes too much. You can look at that at home if you really like. But as I'm going to talk about functions exclusively here, let's just skip over that. So what do we actually now want from in terms of expressivity? For our examples with the doors, for example, we would just like to, well, we would just want to have small modules which where we can take modularity out of and put it into our desired larger module. In a way, like we would just want to cut it out with scissors and put it in our systems. So in the design point of view, what that would be is what we later call mix-ins. So it's small modules in the sense that, for example, it could be these, it could be mappings for a certain name, like this can open, mapping to a specific implementation of this can open. Yeah, I don't know where that goes, but that might be some kind of random number that signifies a method thing. And that would be somehow included in the target mapping that we want to produce via this mix-in operation. By the way, the names for the means that we talk about here are, well, in the original paper, it was quite fixed what a mix-in is, but as time went by and people started to implement actual languages that would feature mix-ins and traits and all that, well, there was a lot of confusion going on and people thinking that they would actually implement something like that, so they would call it. However, that didn't really achieve the same functionality. So there's a lot of different terms out there. There's not so many terms. There's a lot of things that are actually called mix-ins, but are actually not same for traits. So they're all a little bit different. I'm keeping to the original papers where these things actually were introduced. If you find things in your language of choice that are actually called mix-in or trait or something like that, be careful and try to find out what they actually do in order to actually see whether that's really a mix-in or a trait in the sense that you have been introduced to in that language. In that lecture. So mix-in originally was this way of composing two of these mappings to each other, being giving another mapping as an update to the original mapping. And it would for example, if you would introduce that in something like Java, it could look like that. You would have your original door class. You would introduce mixins as special special blocks where you could specify mappings from names to actual implementations. For example, for the can open, you would be more specific than just returning true. You would just only enable it to be open if the person has a certain key or something. If it does not, you would return false. Otherwise, you would defer control to your predecessor via super. That is the key concept of this mixin thing. It somehow can refer to its predecessor, and to the but this predecessor is not really fixed right here. Same, you sorry? We'll see a few slides on. I'm not sure whether Java would be a nice carrier for that, because there's this type system going on, and in that case, there's just there's nothing similar to what mixins really do in the Java type system right now. It's just have for having you for providing you with a syntax that you might identify with. So yeah, same would go for something like short. Would do it in the same way. We would specify for a certain entry specific implementation. Also, you could access your predecessor's implementations, and you could then actually mix the. Well, there's already a little bit of confusion going on. Either calling these modules mixins, and then there's the operation of composing them to each other, which would be mixing them in. So yeah, but. For the actual composition, you would do something like that. You would create a class short door, which would be the composition of short with a door. You could also create locked door by composing locked and door to each other. You could also create composed mixins by somehow connecting short and locked. Also, you could iterate even more things in there and use the composed mix, and that would be kind of the way of how we would like to work with these means. So, in terms of mappings, what do we actually create with that? All that we use here is still our well-known inheritance. It should still work like that. It's still based on preferring the child's methods to the parent's methods. But what we don't want to have anymore is just having constant expressions of inheritance with these inheritance operators and known class names to the left and to the right. But instead, what we want to have here is something like second order type expressions. What does that mean? That means that we would keep one of the operands still open for later binding. The mixin operation would mean that we would provide only the first operand, which contributes the update to the second operand, and leave the second operand free for binding later on, so that we can reuse the update to connect it or to compose it to different things. And with that, we would create somehow a function on types. And that's what the mixin is actually defined as. So the mixin is a constructor that gets something like our classes, in the sense that it gets a mapping, and it produces a function from classes to classes, in the sense that that whenever you build up a term mixin of a certain mapping, that it would mean that as soon as you apply it to some parameter of type class, you will obtain a new class with our original update function C as the as the update to the parameter from this expression. So it's kind of like having an arithmetic with just constants being lifted to an arithmetic that also has variables now. Our expressions can be more flexible now. We just don't have to specify our inheritance clauses and expressions with just constants anymore, but we can leave something variable and bind it later when we do something else with these expressions. Well, as an example, we can have something that we call locked here, which consists in a mapping, and we can now create a function out of that by applying this mixin constructor on that. We would also have to do that on that side, of course, but I'm just lazy. And that would create now a function from classes, which creates also classes in the sense that we have a variable or a parameter. In the lambda calculus, we do it like that. We just write lambda and the name of the parameter. And we would then have this can open mapping to that specific thing. Oh, yeah, my screen is a little bit wider than yours, so misjudged that. I will continue with the inheritance operator here and put the parameter of my expression function in there. So this has to be resolved later on. You can see an example of... well, I actually don't have an example of an actual thing like that over here, but we can maybe create our own. So we had this mixin of locked, which would create such a function. In order to come up with an actual class in the end, we would now have to apply the result of that to something that can be used as a parameter for that function. So thinking back to the example before, we introduced this door thing. That would be a viable parameter for our mixin. So what that would do would be... Is it also? Yeah. Don't know. That would create now such a... such a thing, and door would be applied to that, which would be then door is substituted, X is substituted for door, which would then create locked door. So in the end, finally, we would end up with having locked inherit the mapping locked being an extension for door. But since this thing over here can now live alone, it doesn't need to have the door right now or immediately. We can, of course, also apply it to something different. For example, we could have the mixin locked applied to something else, which would be, for example, our representation of a gate or even a chest or something. In the end, we would come out with something similar to that, so locked extending a gate or locked extending a chest. But with that, we have achieved something that we couldn't do before. We couldn't do this this mapping of one extension to many different different parents. So that is kind of the gain that we get from now having these second order expressions in there. So that would, for example, be quite useful for our synchronization thing, which could now be just mixed into the synced file stream, especially, well, and that was probably a little bit quick from my side to write, read and write in there, because you can actually have it in there instead of in the final target classes. Because, well, you remember you have this this isometric join, which would prefer the, your mixin mapping to the parent mapping. So we could have this read-write over there already, and access the old read-writes via this super reference. So yeah, that is how you would apply these. The mixins in the wrapper scenario. On an implementation level, what would actually be done would be something pretty similar to the aggregation approach. You would have these updates as explicit chains in memory, where you would explicitly navigate via this super connection from one to each other. While working through the list of provided methods, and if you find a signature that suits your call, you would just take the entry that you find over here. If you don't find anything else, you would go to your predecessors, defined functions and all that. So that is kind of the default way that we have seen how names are resolved. Back in times of having this this multiple dispatching resolution, remember there was this way of going through the superchain and searching through the list of provided methods. So that would be the way of how to resolve methods in that context. Maybe you could also find something like working with these virtual tables, like in C++, but you might have to invest a little bit of thinking into that thing. Anyway, what you should take away from that is that whenever you use something like a super keyword now in a system where you have something like mixins, you in the past you could resolve super by just looking at the extension keyword. Now it might not be so so easy anymore, because you have this way of composing your updates on the fly, so that you within something like locked, you for example can't really say anymore what the direct successor will be. So that needs to be evaluated dynamically during runtime, where you actually are able to resolve what super points to. So super needs to be a field present in your class body, so to say, and it needs to be a chain leading to your direct predecessor in terms of in terms of composition of mixins and or connection to classes at some point. Surely you might wonder whether something like multiple inheritance is powerful enough to simulate mixins. So if multiple inheritance comes to mind, C++ is something that always kind of dominates the discussion. And turns out, well, yes and no. C++ can actually have something in the direction of mixins. There. Mixins there are kind of a programming pattern that you can use which are slightly related to what we have talked about now as mixins. However, the mixin pattern that you find in C++ is not based on the multiple inheritance, but it's based on the templating engine in C++, which is the one language feature that enables something like mixins there. So what you would do is, in C++, you would introduce a class template name, super, which means that super is now a variable for a class name in there, and you can use it in your inheritance term here. So super now is not a constant anymore, but is a variable which can be bound later on. So you can have the class syncrv bound to arbitrary classes later on whenever you have the composing the composing expression. And for our purposes, the syncrv mixin would have something like a renewed read operation, which would perform something like acquire and release around the actual read, which would be handled in our predecessor's read function. So we would mention super here and its read in order to dispatch there, and use acquire and release around that. And same would go for the write method, and acquire lock and release lock, of course, would also have to be provided here, but yeah, that's the way it goes. And the actual composing expression would then bind syncrv's class variable name to something like the log open close stream or something like that, which can then itself be another mixin, for example, but doesn't matter so much. You would bind it here, where at the point where you actually then create a class at some point, and have the chain established by the templating engine by connecting these things through the template instantiation. So that would be your way of kind of simulating mixins in C++. Might be quite similar to the theoretical approach. The only thing is that it's a little bit different in the sense that you won't have something like aggregation here, but it's just very aggressive inlining that the template in engine does. So you don't really have an actual super keyword in your language, but it's merely something that that acts as a container that will be replaced at some point with the concrete class name that's going to be mentioned somewhere else, like here. So it's not exactly the same thing. Can be seen, that's what we have already talked about. The C++ mixins was just templated superclasses and can be seen as a coding pattern. Nevertheless, it's still more expressive than just having plain constants for type expressions. If you have a language with true mixins, you have this super keyword, which is more like the aggregation approach to the whole thing. In terms of type systems, you have it's all about modularity, in the sense that whether you have to give your source code with your away with your library or not. And in this, with these templates, you always buy yourself into this world of having to figure out how to ship your code without exposing too much of your internals and all that. And yeah, that's what you buy yourself into with you use very a lot of these templated things. That's completely no topic for the true mixin solution. You can still stay with closed source code, and apart from that, that's just a kind of a hassle-free way of offering something like an alternative to multiple inheritance in the sense that you can just obtain from several modules and join the things into your own world without having true multiple inheritance or even templates within your thing. So it's kind of a lightweight way of getting a very flexible module system. However, you need something like linearization in your language. Otherwise, that's because, well, mixins act with these super chains, so you need some kind of unique parent for your system. Otherwise, yeah, it's just not very expressive in the sense that you want to have these chains that wrap after each other. So anyway, that's what mixins give you, at least in theory. Now let's have a look at a language that actually has something like mixins there. And of course, who would have thought there's something like Ruby in our lecture. That's a language that actually has mixins as concepts in its language backed in, and they're called, of course, not mixins, but modules here. But what they are is actually the same thing as mixins. So you can specify these modules of code that can be attached to other things, like you can compose your short lock door as being a door that is specialized by including the methods from the short module and the methods from the locked module. You can also do that in a more flexible way, like you see here. You can, for example, create a new door and afterwards say that you want it to be extended by the modules short locked, or the module short locked in that sense, which is itself a compositum of short and locked, and it would still work. So yeah, it's out there, kind of works, and yeah, there you go. Apart from that, you might still go on and wonder whether inheritance is even the right means of attacking the problem of reusability. Considering, for example, this structure here, where you have a very complicated diagram, that is a police drone. From year to year, it's even more important to talk about something like that. Appears to me, but well, anyway, police might decide to buy themselves into the drone world, and they might think about having something like a camera plane or even a combat plane. Who knows? Both of them are kind of mountable planes. Well, they're just a basic body and something attached to that, which has fuel and equipment. And equipment could be, for example, for the camera plane, a spy camera, or for the combat plane, something like a precision gun, of course, with just plastic rounds, of course. Anyway, here you can see already the first thing which you would like to decide. For example, you would have something like fuel in your mountable plane, and just modeling your police drone that would be a camera plane and a combat plane at the same time with two times fuel tanks just doesn't make a lot of sense, of course. So the idea would be to have it in one fuel tank and be done with that. Then, of course, you might ask yourself in terms of equipment. Yeah, having the combat plane and the camera plane both react to an actuation of your equipment at the same time might not be what you actually want. So you might want to differentiate between the components inherited from either the combat plane or the camera plane. However, it's just difficult to express in the setting that we have so far, because we've seen it's a uniform decision that we have to take here. We can either decide to share everything that the mountable plane gives us, or to separate everything that's given us. There's just no way of expressing that I want to keep apart the equipment, like the gun and the spy camera, or join both of them, like the fuel tank. And so it's decided on a class level, which might be just too coarse-grained for your needs. I don't remember what that actually is about. So fine-grained specification is one of the things that might not be so nice. Then, but hierarchies, for example, if you are familiar with the way that the Java API is handling their default data structures, you might have encountered something like stacks, which are modeled in the Java world like specialized linked lists, where you have just some additional things like the stack pointer and new methods like push and push many and pop and all that, still inheriting add, remove, and clear from the linked list thing, which are actually then, of course, stack is somehow something like a specialized linked list, but it is specialized in the sense that you have lost a lot of access methods to that thing. So it doesn't feature all the things, but just parts of the things. And all things have been turned obsolete in that sense. And Liskov substitution principle, which is what is actually the principle behind this polymorphism thing, just says that it still needs to stay in order for the stack to be used at all the spots where linked list is actually used. So you find something, put that in front. Find something like that in the Java API documentation, which says, which is actually describing the way that the stack is meant to be used, in the sense that it is not a good idea to actually call the methods that have been inherited from its parent. So, misuse of implementation inheritance seems to be a thing where even API developers of the actual language are not completely they actually at some points fall for that mistake at some points. So that once again stresses the principle that all that is not explicitly prohibited will eventually be done at some point. So if you do design something like a language and have something expressible with the things that you put out there and gonna say, well, nobody's gonna ever use that, so we don't have to care about that, you're clearly in the wrong spirit. So as a kind of a designer of a language, you actually have to care about these things. And I don't say that the Java people didn't care about this polymorphism things, but it's just kind of a general thing when deciding about what to put into a language and what not. So the idea behind this trait approach is to don't offer the same thing in a new color, but instead offer your modeling of problems in a way where you separate the aspect of modeling the hierarchies of relations between things and the composition of the actual functionality to fulfill the needs of your interfaces from the actual process of creating these things, which means that with traits you get several components of your software separate, which have been joined before. You get interfaces to actually design the hierarchical propagation of signatures of methods, and you get traits as the actual carriers of functionality, in the sense that they act as the modules that provide the concrete method implementations that can be then used to fulfill the signatures in the interface. And finally, you get classes as the connecting elements that are kind of entities that combine the interfaces with the traits and wire them up in a way that they should work. So now we go one step back a little bit and look at the theory behind that once again. And we see we have talked about this symmetric join already a little bit before. And turns out what the people from the trait approach actually argue for is to actually use the symmetric join as the composition mechanism in the way that all these carriers of functionality, all these trait things, are thought to be on the same level, so there's no hierarchy between them and no overwriting of the things. And if you assemble functionality from these things, you assemble them on the same level, meaning that if there is things that conflict somehow in naming, you will get an explicit conflicting state. And since that is not so unusual that you would get something like that, they offer means of repairing these conflicts in the sense that it's we don't only have trait sums to compute with our mappings, but also things like exclusion. There is this minus symbol. With that, you would you could apply you could operate such an exclusion of a name from a trait and obtain a new trait that doesn't carry a mapping for that specific name anymore. So you could subtract one mapping from the complete, or one entry from the complete mapping. So you could, in this case, you would take away the entry A from the trait T, which would lead to a name N being resolved to everything that it had been with the old trait, except for if your name would be A, in that case, it would act as it's not defined. Also, what you would like to have is introducing aliases to things that you have already carried in your thing. So you would introduce that arrow thing, which would kind of act as a forwarding intuition. So you would forward all the things that are found under the name A to the entry of B. So the TB would then be resolved as in cases that you would query for A. So yeah, that's it. In the case that we don't talk about A, we will just act as the original trait has acted. So in the end, at some point, you would need to connect all of that to some kind of class, which would provide glue code for that, and that would then just be an asymmetric join, with the intuition that in the asymmetric join, the things that you specify in the class would always override everything that would import from the modules, in the sense that there you could specify your glue code, which would then which could then refer to the module's implementation via the super keyword or something. Okay, that is in the trait world, that would be kind of usually reserved for the last level of composition. Okay, so in terms of designing software with traits, what you would get as constraints is you would consider all the modules equally important. So we have a kind of a flat ordering between all the particular traits. You would have a kind of a precedence of the actual class methods over the imported modules methods, and afterwards, when you have done the import of the modulus methods, you wouldn't be able to perceive any difference anymore. That is this flattening concept. In the case of conflicts, they will surely arise. However, you get means of treating those on the module level with the operations that we have seen so far. So aliasing and exclusion would be one way of resolving the things already on the module level. So it would kind of rename them in order to separate the different methods from each other in case you want to combine the modules that have overlapping method names. And in the end, if there's conflicts from completely different modules, you would be able to sort that out by overwriting with your class methods. So how do they do traits connect to classical languages? There's been several things that you could consider as kind of stepstones to traits into modern languages. For example, let's have a look at C#. There's the concept of having extension methods, which are somewhat on the way to traits. They can be commonly used to specify method definitions in kind of a post-definition way. So you define your class somewhere, and then at some point you decide that you actually would have liked to extend that thing with another definition, but don't have access to your actual class code. So in that sense, you would like to specify that extension somewhere separately, and that's what your extension methods actually does. So you could retrospectively add methods to a type. You would do that by declaring a static class with the definition of your method that you would like to add, while declaring your first parameter explicitly with as the receiver of that call with the modifier this. Import the class to which that should connect into your scope and just call it in fixed form. That would look, for example, like that. Once again, our beloved door example. And notice that we have the short and locked interfaces over here. And now we have a static class that provides us with extension methods to set locked or short, and that would work the way that you would specify, or that you would mark the first parameter with this keyword. Same true over here. And if you do so, you could then in your class short lock door, when that one actually should implement locked and short, which would actually carry no functionality as those are empty interfaces, even though you could still call this can open for the C, which is D. So you could still call can open on that thing, because the extension method can open is defined for these locked interfaces here, and would be considered as now an extension to an already existing type, specifically the short. Is it the short? No, the locked, sorry. So that looks quite convenient and kind of is a way of having a syntactic sugar for just a static method over here. However, that might open up a few problems in terms of how you would use that intuitively. For example, if you start from having an interface locked that specifies an abstract signature like this can open, and you introduce one of these extension methods over here for exactly that locked thing. Turns out, extension methods cannot override abstract signatures. So as soon as you already have a method of the same signature in there, and maybe an abstract method, doesn't matter, doesn't override anymore. So there's also things like the virtual extension methods. That is things that came with Java 8. And to make things quite short, those things actually can override abstract predefined signatures. So in that setting, for example, the interface door offers two abstract methods, can open and can pass. And if you then specify, for example, a locked with an implementation for that can open and a short with an implementation for that can pass, as soon as you compose them together, you will actually have the concrete implementation for can open dominate the abstract version from the door. Thus, it's virtual extension methods. There's a virtual table, or kind of something similar as a virtual table in running here, which means that the actual concrete given implementation of the method can open is dominating the abstract one from can open. With that, you can kind of use traits as a general composition methods by modeling all your hierarchical relations with interfaces and then compose everything with traits as carriers for functionality. And yeah, with that, you end up with the classes only having the glue code remaining that connect the method calls to actual attributes in the end. That's kind of something like simplified multiple inheritance without having to care for all these complicated stuff like we have seen in the multiple inheritance multiple inheritance lecture. However, where are languages with real traits? The closest thing in the practical language that I found was these extension methods. Of course, there's everybody's darling, Smalltalk, and the dialect Squeak. And that one already actually has an implementation of traits. It has a horrible syntax for people who are not really used to that. And I don't really want you to really understand what all this language stuff is all about. You should focus on just one thing, which is the actual inheritance clause over here, which, where you can see there is already something like aliasing in there. There is a trait sum in there. So they have all these things in there, although I think time is not sufficient for actually explaining what the real code does. That's the only thing that I want to tell you about, is there is implementations. It actually works. It just hasn't made it into languages that are actually more practical than Smalltalk dialect. So keep in mind what we have learned today. Traits and mixins and class inheritance are different things. Mixins are all about second-order type operators. Traits are all about composition of modules in a very flexible, fine-grained way, with all the hassle you have to do with renaming and all that. So there's nothing like a superchain hierarchy that takes away anything for you. And you can combine all these principles in certain ways to achieve an actual practical language, as we have seen in all the examples throughout the lecture. Yeah, if you come ever into doubt how traits, mixins, and class inheritance are different from each other, take a look at that slide once again. As a lessons learned, mixins are a low-effort alternative to multiple inheritance and actually work as second-order type expressions. Traits are for fine-grained control, separate composition from specification. That is the actual principles. If you're more interested into things, get yourself the slides and have a more closer look at though this lengthy list. So thank you for your attention. See you all on Friday at 10 o'clock, I think we said. I have to still change the timetable, but yeah, that's what we said. So.